From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Poet Minnie Bruce Pratt just won an award from the Fund for Free Expression. She almost lost an NEA grant because she writes about being a lesbian. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the subject that she's written about for the past 10 years, losing custody of her two sons when she came out and fell in love with another woman. Also today, a talk with Alex Chilton. As the lead singer with the Box Tops, he topped the charts with the hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby. But it's his more obscure records with his band Big Star that made him an important influence on other musicians. And we have reviews of new Brazilian music and the history of the Borscht Belt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There have been violent demonstrations in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, on the day after an agreement was reached in London that transfers power to former rebel groups. The BBC's Colin Blaine reports.
Demonstrations have broken out in several parts of the city and have been directed against the EPRDF, who invaded yesterday, and against the United States, who brokered this week's peace talks in London. There have been protests at the U.S. Embassy, at the city's main cathedral, and in an impromptu march around the center of the capital. For a time, we could hear only the sound of chanting. Then troops of the EPRDF opened fire to disperse the crowd. The crowd's anger seems to have been sparked off by news that a provisional government's to be set up in Eritrea. There were chants of one Ethiopia and claims that the United States had betrayed the country. Westerners traveling in vehicles were attacked, and a number of demonstrators appear to have been shot and wounded. Several Americans have taken refuge in their embassy. One EPRDF fighter said the demonstrations had been orchestrated by supporters of the old regime. He said the situation wasn't stable enough to allow such protests to be held.
The BBC's Colin Blaine in Addis Ababa. President Bush today announced a major initiative to stop the arms race in the Middle East. He made his proposal at graduation ceremonies at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. The plan would curb the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons in the Mideast, as well as the ballistic missiles that can deliver them. The proposal has already won some initial support from Congress. Israel has reacted cautiously. Rodney King, the man who Los Angeles police officers were taped beating with their batons, was arrested last night for allegedly trying to run down a police officer. More from NPR's Katie Davis.
According to a police spokesman, King had picked up a male prostitute dressed as a woman in Hollywood. Police officers say when members of the Vice Squad approached his car, King suddenly backed up, swerved close to an officer, and drove off. King was stopped moments later by a patrol car and was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon against a police officer. He was released early this morning without being formally charged. The case will be turned over to the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office to decide whether or not to pursue charges. King's lawyer issued a brief statement today saying, "It is obvious that Mr. King is a very upset and confused person and certainly regrets this incident." Four police officers are facing criminal assault charges in the videotaped March 3rd arrest of Rodney King. I'm Katie Davis in Los Angeles.
Yugoslavia's Republic of Croatia declared itself an independent state today. The announcement coincided with a visit by a group of European Community diplomats who are urging the Yugoslav republics to stick together. On Wall Street today, stocks closed higher. The Dow rose 10.25 points to 2969.59. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. Three former vice presidents of First National Bank in Chicago were among nine former bank employees and vendors charged today with fraud and bribery. The U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI announced the charges this afternoon. The government says that the alleged schemes between 1979 and 1989 included bribe and kickback payments to the bank officials. The alleged payments included bank contracts, real estate and restaurant leases, and entertainment and consulting contracts for telephones. Republican Jake Garn of Utah says he's retiring from the U.S. Senate. Garn made the announcement today in Salt Lake City. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Senator Garn told a press conference at the Utah State Capitol that he will not run for re-election next year. For three terms, Garn has been one of the Senate's most conservative Republicans. He once flew in the space shuttle and became NASA's strongest Senate advocate. He made his announcement today surrounded by his family, and said that after 25 years in public office, It was time to devote more time to his children and 10 grandchildren. The Utah senator said he and his family made the retirement decision 5 years ago. He said he will continue to be a public person, but will not run for another office. Garn also vowed to be active in his remaining year and a half in the Senate, but he says he has no regrets about leaving. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
Kremlin envoy Yevgeny Primakov talked with Secretary of State James Baker today about a new Soviet economic plan. Baker says, however, he'll defer his opinion about the plan until after he's looked at it closely. Baker adds that he's convinced that Soviet leaders are seriously aiming for a market economy. Primakov's talks in the U.S. are critical. The Soviet economy is lagging. President Mikhail Gorbachev is trying to raise Western aid to prevent his economy's collapse. Primakov is in Washington primarily looking for agricultural credits for the USSR. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Fund for Free Expression, a committee of Human Rights Watch, gave cash awards last week to 23 writers who are victims of political persecution. The money is from the estates of Lillian Hellman and Dashiell Hammett, who each resisted the communist hunts of the McCarthy era. My guest, Minnie Bruce Pratt, is one of the writers recognized for her courage by the Fund for Free Expression. Right-wing groups have tried to suppress her work because she writes about being a lesbian. For the past 10 years, she's been writing poems about the most traumatic experience of her life, losing custody of her two sons to her husband after she'd fallen in love with another woman. Her collection, Crime Against Nature, was chosen as the 1989 Lamont Poetry Selection by the Academy of American Poets. The judges wrote, in spare and forceful language, Pratt tells a moving story of loss and recuperation, discovering linkages between her own disenfranchisement and the condition of other minorities. Pratt grew up in Selma, Alabama, and now teaches women's studies at George Washington University. She shared her Fund for Free Expression Award with two other lesbian writers, Audre Lorde and Christos.
The three of us were grouped together by the attacks by the right wing on homoerotic art, and we were given the award together. I may be wrong about this, but I think that this may be the first time that a mainstream international human rights group has recognized persecution based on lesbian and gay issues. Amnesty International, not Amnesty USA, but Amnesty International, does not recognize persecution based on lesbian and gay orientation. And I don't think any other mainstream group does either. So I feel like this is an extremely, extremely important award simply because of that.
Well, now you've just gotten this award in support of your writing. What has happened lately to try to suppress your writing?
Well, after Senator Helms asked the General Accounting Office to investigate us because he thought government money was being misused in our awards.
This is NEA grants.
This is the NEA grants, right. Those attacks were picked up by other people over the last year, including the American Family Association out of Tupelo, Mississippi, which...
That's Donald Wildman's
group. That's Donald Wildman. They mount campaigns against media kinds of things that they consider to be pornographic. Their definition is extremely narrow. Anything which doesn't espouse heterosexual, nuclear family, Christian, so-called Christian fundamentalist values on the TV or radio or in writing, they consider to be pornographic. So they sort of singled us out, especially me. They singled me out and asked folks to write to their congresspeople and demand that my award be taken away and so forth. And people did write in, but the NEA hasn't moved to remove the awards.
I wonder how upset you get when one of these very conservative groups tries to suppress your writing or to block a grant. In many ways, the climate has become much more liberal on sexual issues. On the other hand, at the same time, there are certain groups that have become more aggressive in trying to suppress certain values.
Well, I get very upset, and it's a complicated kind of being upset. When Senator Helms began his attacks, I found myself getting terribly, terribly afraid. And I questioned that because nothing had actually happened to me. You know, he was attacking us verbally. He was trying to rouse up opinion against us, but in fact, nothing had happened. Yet I found myself being awfully afraid.
Like, and physically afraid?
Just deeply, deeply shaken. And I realized that partly I was shaken because the attacks were coming specifically about the poems I had written about my relationship with my children, who I had lost custody of as a lesbian while I was living in North Carolina, while Senator Helms was my senator. So that the attacks on the writing brought back all of the trauma of the custody battle. But in addition, it went deeper than that. I became terribly afraid, and I realized I was going back to the events of my childhood. I grew up in the Deep South in Alabama during my teenage years were during the civil rights battles. I heard the worst kinds of racism in my family and all around me, the worst kind of hatred and bigotry. And the attacks that Senator Helms was leading brought back the authoritarian atmosphere of those years for me very strongly. The effort in my community when I was growing up to block any dissent from the status quo, from the mainstream opinions, from the opinions of the town, the effort to block that, not just with what black folks were doing, but to block any dissent by white people, by ostracism or ridicule or worse, you know, violence. So my reaction to these attacks is very deep and very strong, and I feel it's very, very important for people to see that it isn't just about an attack on the arts, that it's interconnected to many other different kinds of censoring activities that are going on. I'm extremely upset by the recent Supreme Court decision that bans folks who get federal funding in abortion and family planning clinics from giving information to their patients about abortion. I see that as completely connected to the kinds of things that are happening around the arts.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Minnie Bruce Pratt. She's a poet, and her most recent book, Crime Against Nature, was awarded the Lamont Poetry Award by the Academy of American Poets. And she was just awarded the Hemet Hellman Award from the Fund for Free Expression. She's one of several writers who was just honored with this award. Let's talk about your poems. Your latest book is called Crime Against Nature. Would you explain what the title refers to?
It's the name of the sodomy statute in the state of North Carolina, which, of course, makes same-sex love a felony in North Carolina, and actually, I believe, 25 other states in the District of Columbia. The statute itself, Crime Against Nature statute, is language from it is on the cover of the book, and then parts of it turn up in the title poem as well. It's really a pretty sobering thought as a poet to consider that one is also a potential felon, so that was definitely on my mind when I was writing the book.
Were you living in North Carolina when you went through your divorce and lost custody of your children?
That's right. I was living in North Carolina, but I wasn't living there when I wrote the book. I was living in the District of Columbia.
No, almost all the poems in Crime Against Nature are about how your sons were taken away from you when you came out. Your husband won custody in court because you were a lesbian?
Actually, we never went to court. He got custody of them, but the fight went on between our lawyers and between us. My lawyer said to me, "Don't go to court in North Carolina. You'll never see your children again." So I had to do a lot of pretty resourceful negotiating and opposing to just win the right to see them periodically. And in fact, one of the poems in the book, The Laughing Place, is about looking back on that time when I was fighting so hard. At one point I hired a detective to track my husband so I would have some kind of evidence to bargain with in against his accusations that I was a lesbian.
So what kind of settlement did you reach out of court?
For a long time, I said to myself, oh, well, I got a father's visiting agreement. And then when I was writing this book, I went back and actually looked at my divorce decree and compared it to the decree of a man who had gotten visitation rights for his children. And, of course, what I got was much, much worse. For a long time, I was only, according to this decree, I was only supposed to see my children in the presence of my mother or one of my maternal aunts. I wasn't able to have them be in my home if I was living with any other person. There were things like that. I did manage to see them two or three times a year throughout their growing up and talk to them on the phone. But it was really a struggle. I did a lot of long-distance driving, 14 hours straight, to try to see them for a weekend or a long weekend. And another one of the poems in the book, Seven Times Going, Seven Times Coming Back, talks about driving over the Smoky Mountains and crossing a river over and over again, trying to get to them.
Let me ask you to read one of your poems from your book, Crime Against Nature. And this is a poem called The Child Taken from the Mother. You can introduce it in any way you'd like.
A lot of the poems in this book were written because I would talk about my life with people and they would ask me questions, and I ended up writing poems as a kind of response to the questions. So The Child Taken from the Mother is one of those poems. I'm going to read parts of this poem. I could do nothing, nothing. Do you understand? Women ask, why didn't you? Like they do of women who've been raped, and I ask myself, why didn't I? Why didn't I run away with them or face him in court? Or 10 years ago I answered myself, no way for children to live, or the chance of absolute loss, or I did the best I could. It was not enough. It was about terror and power. I did everything I could. Not enough. A woman's voice, those women who've never held a little baby in their arms. In the old window, a shadow, two hands, brick and mortar, seal the house, my children somewhere inside. The youngest has lost his baby fat, navel flattened, last of my stomach's nourishing. You say, do something. You say, why is this happening? My body, my womb, my body of a woman, a mother, a lesbian, and here, perhaps you say, that last word doesn't belong. Woman, mother, those can stay. Lesbian, no, put that outside the place of the poem. Too slangy, prosy, obvious, just doesn't belong. Why don't you? Why didn't you? Can't you say it some other way?
How old were your sons when you lost custody of them?
They were 7 and 6, and they're now 23 and 21. They're quite grown.
Are there any regulations surrounding how you see them now?
No. As they came into their adolescence, the restrictions around seeing them loosened significantly, and we were able to spend a bit more time together. They and I have a quite wonderful relationship, and that's been nourished through lots of long-distance phone calls and other kinds of conversation, and they come and stay with me now.
In one of your poems, you wrote, if I had been more ashamed, if I had hid my lust, I might not have lost them. And in another poem, you write, I paid for my freedom with my children. You must have gone through terrible feelings of guilt, not necessarily for being gay, but for coming out, I mean, for expressing it, for acting on it.
I had not started out being ashamed of falling in love with another woman and needing to start a different kind of life for myself. But by the time I had come through the separation and divorce and custody struggle, I did have a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. the process was designed to make me feel guilty and ashamed, because the people I was struggling with, the court system, my husband, my family, all thought I was really doing something quite disgusting. And even though I knew that what I was doing was right for me and ultimately would be good for the children because they would have a mother who they saw living her life with integrity, I did have this terrible grief that we were having to go through so much pain to get to this new place.
Didn't you write that your mother was prepared to be a character witness against you if this was in court?
Actually, what I've said about my mother's role in this is that my husband threatened to call her as a character witness on his behalf, and she certainly disapproved strongly of what I was doing. He also threatened to tell me he had secretly Xeroxed chapters of my journal and was going to submit them in court. So that was certainly something that I, when folks talk to me about how afraid they are sometimes to write down their secrets, I talk about that incident as sort of the ultimate threat that a writer can face about having your writing used against you, which, of course, does happen in many different ways. And I just, I did not let that keep me from continuing to write. I just was determined I was going to have my life whole and complete and offer that to my children. And that included my going ahead and writing about my life.
Minnie Bruce Pratt, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks. I was happy to be with you.
Minnie Bruce Pratt just won a Fund for Free Expression Award. Her latest collection of poems is Crime Against Nature. Coming up, the Brazilian music known as forró. This is Fresh Air. Whenever someone wants to prove that a kind of music enjoys real popularity, the argument goes that it's music of the people, authentic, low budget, no glamour. World music commentator Milo Miles says usually these claims are exaggerated, but they do apply to the Brazilian style known as forró.
If you imagine a little piano or organ you can carry around with you that's still loud enough to fill a good-sized room, you have an approximation of the accordion. I would estimate that the accordion is the most commonly transported instrument worldwide, next to the guitar. This mobility helps explain why accordion is at the heart of so many kinds of down-home music played on Saturday nights, music like zydeco, polka, and Brazilian forró. Forró, however, is considerably newer than zydeco or polka. In fact, its foundation can be dated precisely to 1946, when accordionist Luiz Gonzaga recorded Baion, which is both the name of the song and its rhythm. Baion was very big for a while, and the beat never went away entirely, but it did not stay pure for long. In America, Baion lingered on in many tunes written by Lieber and Stoller for groups like the Drifters, Under the Boardwalk, for example.
Oh, when the sun beats down and burns the tar up on the roof, and your shoes get so hot you wish your tired feet were fireproof, under the boardwalk, down by the sea, on a blanket with my baby's where I.
In northeastern Brazil, Gonzaga and other performers modified Baion, making the accents a bit sharper, more syncopated, and soon the style forró was born. Nowadays, it's played year-round and not just during carnival season.
O fole roncou no alto da serra, foi Juventina quem mandou a concertina meu juízo revirar. Eu sei que morro de bala, de carabina, mas o amor de Juventina me dá forças pra brigar.
Lore has it that the original lineup of a Forró group was merely the accordion, a very simple bass drum, and a triangle. Of course, modern groups expand way beyond that instrumentation and into hybrids like Forró rock and Forró merengue. Indeed, several different rhythms and kinds of songs are lumped together under Forró. But no matter what the precise variety, the slightly ragtag quality of a lot of Forró is one of its major charms. You know how the smart set in America now considers the lambada completely tacky? Well, that's how suave types in Brazil regard Forró. Even David Byrne can't make Forró respectable, but he has put together an exemplary sampler called Forró, etc. You get 18 selections featuring Gonzaga, his compatriots and competitors, liner notes that explain who everybody is, and some sassy lyric translations. Though clever, earthy idioms abound, many Forró tunes just say, "Let's boogie, get drunk, and make out." Others, however, add a distinct bite to the party music. This next number, called Chewing Gum and Banana, declares that Brazil will play more North American music when Uncle Sam plays more Brazilian music.
Eu só boto bipap no meu samba quando o tio Sam tocar um tamborim. Quando ele pegar no pandeiro e um zabumba, quando ele aprender que o samba não é rumba, aí eu vou misturar Miami com Copacabana, chiclete eu misturo com banana, e o meu samba vai ficar assim. Puiurururururipap, bipap, 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 bipap. Eu quero ver a confusão. Bipap, 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 bipap. Olha aí, o samba rock, meu irmão. É, mas em compensação, eu quero ver o bugue-yugue de pandeiro e violão. Eu quero ver o tio sangue, frigideira, a de uma batucada brasileira.
How many Forró collections does a world music fan need? Well, one may be enough, but none is surely too few. There are several others available, but the second one to get is called Brazil, Forró Music for Maids and Taxi Drivers. Even if it spotlights performers that are not as well known as those on Forró, etc., Music for Maids and Taxi Drivers has a very unassuming atmosphere of everyday fun that I quite like. It underscores the music's gregarious block party personality.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge. He reviewed two albums, Forró, etc., on the Lucabop Warner Brothers label, and Music for Maids and Taxi Drivers on Rounder Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with Alex Chilton. In the late 60s, he was the lead singer with the Box Tops. Alex Chilton was 17 when he recorded that. By the time he was 20, he was recording more personal and idiosyncratic material. Those records never became hits, but they inspired what became known as power pop. Also, we have a review of a new book about the famous resorts of the Borscht Belt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Two rebel groups of Ethiopia have indicated that they might not be part of a new government worked-out plan at a conference in London. Yesterday, three rebel factions agreed to a U.S.-mediated plan for a peace settlement. Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The Eritrean People's Liberation Front, who've been fighting for independence for 30 years, said they would not participate in a transitional Ethiopian government. Instead, they would set up a provisional government in Eritrea until an independence referendum could be held. The Oromo Liberation Front, representing Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, also said it wanted to hold an independence vote. The Oromo said the other party in the talks, the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, was not consulting them on setting up the transition government. EPRDF spokesman denied the charge. Despite today's developments, the United States government spokesman indicated that yesterday's agreement was still in place and said it was hopeful for a peaceful solution to Ethiopia's problems. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Goldfarb in London.
GOP Senator Jake Garn has announced that he will not seek another term in office because he wants to spend more time with his family. He was first elected senator from Utah in 1974 and says that being a senator is not a normal life. Garn served 6 years as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee and back in 1985 flew on board the Space Shuttle Discovery on a week-long flight. India's Congress has chosen a new president, P.V. Narasimha Rao. He has served in Indian politics for 5 decades and takes the place of the assassinated former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. Sam Miller filed this report for the BBC.
Thanking the Congress Working Committee for electing him as party president, Mr. Narasimha Rao said that this was a time of both deep gloom and great challenge. Only the Congress Party, he continued, could preserve the unity and integrity of the country. Mr. Narasimha Rao comes from the southern state of Andhra Pradesh and served in the governments of both Rajiv Gandhi and his mother Indira. Because he is 70 years old and has recently recovered from a serious operation, his appointment is seen as a compromise interim measure, and he won't necessarily be the party's candidate for the post of Prime Minister. It is expected that the party will now move into a period of collective leadership, and the posts of Congress President on the one hand and Parliamentary Leader and potential Prime Minister on the other may in the future be separated.
Sam Miller reporting for the BBC from New Delhi. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 10 points to close at 2,969.59 on volume of some 188 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. According to a Soviet spokesman, Soviet leader Gorbachev wants to attend a financial summit meeting in London this summer to outline a program of changes, not plead for money. The Soviet president has said that Western nations should be willing to spend as much saving the Soviet economy as they did fighting Iraq, which he said cost $100 billion. U.S. Secretary of State Baker has said the idea of offering aid to Moscow if the Soviets introduce market reforms is not inconsistent with past policies. In New York City, the U.N. Security Council is close to approving a plan that requires Iraq to pay for the destruction of its most dangerous weapons. Linda Fasulo reports from the U.N.
Diplomats say the U.S. and Britain have proposed a draft resolution that approves the Secretary General's plan for destroying Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, but demands that Baghdad be liable for the costs. And the measure would also extend the 45-day deadline set by the Council for destroying the weapons. The UN chief has proposed a three-part plan. The UN is to find and inspect the weapons, dispose of them either on-site or at special locations, and then monitor Baghdad's long-term disarmament. Meanwhile, a team of experts is expected to arrive in Iraq in early June to inspect its chemical weapons. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Iran's oil minister says that oil prices will go down if OPEC decides to raise its output. A $21 a barrel price was agreed upon by OPEC last year and is more than $3 above current market prices. OPEC oil ministers will meet in Vienna next week in order to talk about production levels. In trading today in Europe, the dollar was mixed against other foreign currencies. Gold prices moved down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. To a lot of people who came of age in the 60s, Alex Chilton is best known as the singer with the box tops. He's the growly voice on The Letter and Cry Like a Baby. After his AM radio hits, Chilton left the box tops and formed his own band, Big Star. This band was a commercial flop, but their records from the 70s influenced a lot of younger musicians and made Chilton a cult figure. The Big Star albums led Village Voice rock critic Robert Christgau to call Chilton the inventor of self-conscious power pop and to describe Chilton's music as prophetically idiosyncratic and breathtakingly original. The Replacements recently recorded a song in tribute to him called Alex Chilton. Rhino Records has collected many of the songs from his obscure Big Star albums, along with some of Chilton's work from the 80s, on a new anthology called 19 Years, A Collection of Alex Chilton. But let's start where Chilton's recording career began, with a number one hit.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
Alex Chilton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
I want to talk with you first about the early part of your recording career. You started recording with the Box Tops when you were 16. Can you tell me how you got a chance like that at such a young age?
Well, Memphis was a hotbed of recording activity, Memphis, where I grew up. And, you know, I was asked to join a kind of successful local band who made records at sort of a successful independent producer's studio. And after I'd been with them about a month, we went in the studio and recorded our first hit song. And so it was just something that was easy to fall into. It was sort of like growing up in Hollywood next door to MGM's studio lot or something, you know?
Right. Now, on those early sessions with the Box Tops, you have this real, you know, kind of rough, growly kind of voice. And your voice is completely different on your subsequent work. Did you sing that way at the time, or were you asked to sing that way?
Well, the producer of the band was a strong influence on how we sounded, and he would sort of demonstrate to me how he wanted things sung, and I would pretty much just imitate his singing. His name was Dan Penn, still is Dan Penn.
So did you feel like it wasn't really you on the records in that respect?
In a way, I do. I listen to it and I go, wow, Dan's really in voice today. It sounds more like Dan than it does myself to me.
What was it like handling fame at the age of 16? Were you prepared for it?
Oh, I mean, I don't know that anybody's prepared to handle fame. But then again, I think it would have made a lot more difference if I'd been a true believer in my own fame, too. But as it was, you know, we were kind of doing the bidding of producers and recording songs that were not our own, and it was sort of a job to me. I wasn't such a great fan of our group that I was really caught up in thinking that I was a tremendous great artist or anything at the time.
When did you leave the Box Tops and start your own group?
In 1970, I left the Box Tops, and I guess the next year I started the group called Big Star.
Now, let me ask you about one of the first records that you made on your own after the Box Tops, and this is a song you wrote called Free Again that kicks off the compilation, the Alex Chilton CD that Rhino recently brought out. Do you want to say anything about what was going through your mind when you wrote the song?
Sure. You know, I guess that it's some kind of tune of some kind of liberation as far as the lyrics. But I was a big fan of the Flying Burrito Brothers at the time, and, you know, country rock was sort of something I was getting interested in. So it sounds very country rocky and, you know, with the pedal steel guitar and all.
Let's hear it. When you formed the band Big Star, was there an intended irony behind the name?
I guess so. We'd been together for some time without a name, and somehow it just there was a store across the street called the Big Star, and while wondering what we should call ourselves, we looked across the street, and somehow it seemed perfect. So I guess, yeah, there was an irony in calling our first album number one record by a group called Big Star. I guess we thought it was funny at the time.
Yeah, well, I guess it kind of stayed funny in the sense that never...
That we never sold any records, yeah.
Was that a great disappointment to you?
I don't know. I wasn't really counting on selling a whole lot of records or anything, you know. I mean, I thought that someday if we ever sold any records, I might make some money out of it. That myth has been exploded for me also. But, you know, I didn't have any great emotional investment in the success or failure of the record in commercial terms.
Yeah, choose one of the songs from the early sessions that really still works for you, you know what I mean, that really sums up for you the kind of sound you wanted to get.
Well, my favorite song from the first Big Star record is called In the Street, you know, and I think that that's sort of the best song that I wrote in that period, and somehow it just turned out great, you know, on tape. These things happen sometimes for no good reason.
Let's hear it. Your records ended up being very influential to a lot of bands who were coming up at the time. The Replacements even have a song called Alex Chilton. When did you get a sense of the impact that your music was having on other musicians, even if it wasn't having a big impact commercially?
I guess in the late 70s, I spent some time in New York, and it seemed like everybody I ran into there, you know, claimed to be a fan of the Big Star albums and that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I guess it was around then that I began to see that even though we hadn't sold any records or made any money out of the albums, that they were still some kind of success in a way, you know.
What would they tell you? What kind of specific stories did people tell you about the impact your music had on them?
Mostly what it is young guys coming up who are like learning to play guitar, you know. They seem to reach a certain stage where this record shows them something, you know. It's that I think that's what people go for about it. That's what they all seem to gravitate toward, is this jangly guitar sound that's happening there.
My guest is Alex Chilton. He started his career as the lead singer of the Box Tops. His more obscure subsequent recordings are collected on the CD 19 Years, a collection of Alex Chilton. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chilton is my guest. A lot of people call your music one of the first albums of power pop. What does that expression mean to you?
I don't know, really. I mean, to me, we were more like, our band was more like the mid-60s British invasion music. You know, it was like three-minute pop songs that were kind of unpretentious and very basically about love and just being a teenager and having a good time. You know, for me, music, once it entered the psychedelic era there in the 60s, I became less interested in it. I like simple pop songs with no real message, you know, just about feeling good and being happy.
Are you ever on the oldies circuit playing?
Absolutely, yeah.
You are?
Yeah, I played a gig with the Beach Boys a couple of weeks ago. That was thrilling. I got to even sing Surfin' USA on stage with them. It was the greatest thrill of my career.
So what's it like for you on the oldie circuit? Tell me what you like and dislike about it.
Well, I enjoy meeting all these bands that I've heard of for so long. You know, like, I've played some gigs lately with Question Mark from Question Mark and the Mysterians, and he's a lot of fun. It's interesting to be, you know, hanging around hotel lobbies with Question Mark and that sort of stuff. So, you know, in the summer times, it seems like people offer me some gigs, you know, with 60s bands and things like that, and it's fun to do now and then.
So what do you play?
Well, it's pretty strictly Box Tops material that's called for, and usually it's a five-song set, you know, so it's kind of easy money. You just get up and play five or six tunes at a county fair in Iowa or North Dakota or something, and it's kicky, you know, what can I say?
In the late 70s, you started becoming really part of the punk scene, and you produced records by the Cramps. You produced their first records. What attracted you to that? You'd already been around a while, and a lot of people in it were just coming up.
I don't know, everybody since the 60s, it seems like everybody who was still interested in playing rock and roll kept looking for, well, where is the new scene going to be, you know? We've got to have a scene going here so that we can all get involved in it and do good things. And I think that in New York in the mid-70s was the nearest thing to a scene like the London scene or the Los Angeles scene in the 60s, you know. So I sort of gravitated to it because there was an anarchistic sort of edge to it, and it wasn't some corporate showcase of Stepford Wives bands, you know, playing up there. It was real rebellious, good rock and roll that was coming from street level rather than corporate boardroom level.
Do you still think of your rock and roll as being rebellious?
I don't know. I do in a way that it doesn't conform to industry standards, you know. I mean, I am a very rebellious person against the society that we live in. I'm not so sure that comes out in a big way in the music that I'm doing at the moment, but one goes through different phases, you know. I mean, just sometimes the most outrageous thing you could do would be to do the most normal thing that anybody could do, which is sort of a plan that I have right now. If I may, the next music that I'm making, I'm thinking of making it the most sort of. I don't know how to describe it, but some very very normal, uncontroversial pop tunes, you know, that have nothing much kinky about them except a strong beat and a positive outlook, you know.
You've been so influential on so many people in rock, and yet, you know, you're kind of functioning independently. You don't have a record contract. There isn't a big company after you to record something now. What explanation do you have for... I'm always interested when someone of your talents is kind of not more sought after.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It seems to me that the world is full of great musicians who don't have any record companies interested in them. It seems to me that the record companies are interested in bands of teenage guys, you know, with long hair and playing heavy metal music, or whatever the next trend will be, you know. And I'm not really so concerned about it. I mean, I've sort of got my scene going and have carved out a little niche, however little it is, in the music business, you know, and I managed to play as many gigs as I want every year and make money doing that and make a little money here and there making records, and it's okay with me.
What is that scene?
What is the niche that I've carved out, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I can play in these college towns and get my records played on college radio and that sort of stuff.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Alex Chilton's records from the 70s and 80s are on the new CD, 19 Years, a collection of Alex Chilton, on Rhino Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from Ethiopia?
Terry, we have a report from one of the Americans who was attacked by anti-American protesters in Addis Ababa today, as the citizens of that city began to be concerned about the kind of government they are going to get. The two interests have split in Ethiopia. The Eritreans say they will not participate in the government pending their own nation's independence, and we'll talk with some Eritrean refugees. We also have a piece on river pilots on the Mississippi piloting those big tankers in from the Gulf.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Maybe your only brush with the resort hotels of the Catskill Mountains was watching the movie Dirty Dancing. If you want the real story, critic Maureen Corrigan recommends the new book, It Happened in the Catskills.
Last weekend, I took a trip to Thomas Jefferson's estate, Monticello, in Virginia. What a place! When our tour reached the dining room of the main house, the guide told us that dinner on a normal evening there consisted of some 30 courses. Not bad, but nothing compared to what was considered an average meal at Grossinger's. For breakfast alone, 7 kinds of herring were on the menu: fried, baked, pickled, marinated, kippered, tomato, and matches. You could wash the herring down with some sauerkraut juice, maybe try some French toast and Cheerios, and then it was almost time for lunch. For all his visionary genius and appreciation for fine cuisine, I bet Jefferson never could figure out how to get good deli at Monticello. It Happened in the Catskills is a wistful look at those fabulous Jewish resorts like Grossinger's, the Concord, Kutcher's, and the Nevelly. These hotels had their heyday from the 1930s to the 1970s, and most of the people who stayed there weren't wealthy. Many guests were one generation removed from European ghettos, and they saved all year for their vacations. Then, for 2 magical weeks, they lived better than royalty or founding fathers. There are hundreds of old photographs in this book, together with the recollections of guests, hotel owners, kitchen staff, and performers. The Catskills, or Borscht Belt as it came to be known, was a training ground and showplace for stars. Would you believe opera singer Robert Merrill sharing a double bill with the Three Stooges? Or how about Maurice Chevalier headlining at the Concord, where he was introduced as Maurice Chevrolet? Eddie Fisher, Wilt Chamberlain, Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, Dr. Henry Kissinger, and the Rolling Stones, they all played the Catskills. To compete with such glamorous acts, smaller hotels had to rely on creative advertising. One musician, Eddie Finkel, recalls working at a flea bag called the New Edgewood Hotel. Finkel says that the owner would put big ads in the newspapers: Fisherman's Paradise, The lake was mostly swamp. Olympic swimming pool. It was 4 feet deep. The Catskills resorts were family-owned places where the same guests would return every summer. Tanya Grossinger remembers getting reservation letters that read like this: "I'd like to bring my family up from the 4th of July to Labor Day. We'd like to reserve Sadie the waitress and Meyer the bellhop. Please give us the same room and table that we always have." By the 1970s, the Catskills resorts had started to decline. People who had vacationed there now wanted to go someplace more exotic. The hotels were also hurt by TV, which made live entertainment look tame, and by the nutrition craze, which made all that herring look lethal. Grossinger's was sold in 1985, and many of the other hotels have been turned into health clubs and ashrams. It Happened in the Catskills offers a wonderful package plan vacation back to a time when all you had to worry about was perfecting your Mahjong score and your Mambo steps and waiting for the dinner bell to ring.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed It Happened in the Catskills, edited by Myrna and Harvey Fromer. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Dan Laughlin, and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a subject that a lot of people have trouble talking about, families and money. We talk with sociologist Marcia Millman, author of Warm Hearts and Cold Cash, about how husbands and wives, parents and children deal with money. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.